Okay, welcome to the last session. I do not have one of those fancy time things because I'm taking notes on my computer.
Thank you.
If someone wants to donate a computer to the cause, they're welcome.
Why don't you take mine?
Your CPU's not fast enough to handle seconds.
What's the name of the site?
So this last session is optimistically titled, How Shall We Fix the World? How do we fix the world? Which is good because it's been a long 2 days, about time we found out. Who is ready?
I'm ready.
Oh, good. So we will start with David.
He's first on the list anyway.
Which is why I'm ready.
Which is why he's ready. You have approximately 10 minutes.
Thanks. Well, my name is David Mandel, for those of you who I still haven't met, and I'm from the Thinking, Risk, and Intelligence Group in the Adversarial Intent section at Defense Research and Development Canada, which is an agency that is part of the Department of National Defense. I lead a group there which is comprised mainly of experimental psychologists focused on applying experimental psychology to understanding intelligence analysis and risk assessment. I expressed some trepidation when I was first invited to this conference because I didn't feel that I was an expert on terrorism. I've now been bumped up to a session on how do we fix the world. So I'm feeling extremely high if I rated my confidence at the moment, but I'll try to say a couple of things on the general topic, and then to hedge my bets, what I've decided to do is to save about 5 minutes to present the results of a calibration study which deals with the performance of a division of intelligence analysts who are obviously tasked with security-related issues. So, general observations in three parts. First of all, the first observation is that we should be wary of purported world fixers. So, instigators of collective violence have often come dressed up in the garb of people who are world fixers, who have utopian visions, that they're usually more than willing to make other people die for. So, to quote Stalin, death solves all problems. No man, no problem. We're familiar with the anti-idealist's expression that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And I would submit that given humanity's track record in terms of world fixers coming along and trying to solve the world, that we might also consider the expression that even if it's broke, I'll take it broke, thank you very much. So that's the first of 3 points. The second two are really related to one another, and I guess the point I want to make is that it's important to specify the respects in which something is broke, whether we're talking about the world or a lesser problem. And I think that in considering this, you encounter a catch-22 situation. Because on the one hand, you have to specify what are the conditions, what is the state of the world. On the other hand, you have to specify what you want to achieve, how it ought to be. And it becomes, I think, abundantly clear that both of those tasks are subjective to some extent. The specification of what is subjective on the one hand, and on the other hand, the specification of what ought to be is value-based. So you're dealing with people's perceptions of reality and their perceptions of where they want to move reality. I think it's important to note that this isn't, I'm not trying to make a pitch in favor of ethical relativism, to which I'm both intellectually and effectively opposed, but I think it points to the problem of the title of this panel, which is how do you fix the world? That is, from my perspective, the discrepancy between what is and what ought may be very different than the discrepancy from your perspective. And as you multiply that by a large number of agents, even if we're talking about agents as nation states, the problem and the complexity becomes, I think, evident. that brings me to the second point, which is, or third point, which is really an extension of that second one, that we have to consider not only the that tension between two different subjective assessments, namely our perception of what is and our value-based assessment of what ought to be, but we have to, if we're thinking about solving the world from a strategic, solving the problems of the world from a strategic point of view, do that over multiple agents. And then, in some sense, we have to assess not only how it works for ourselves, but how things vary across agents in terms of those various dimensions. I think it's from some weakly structured analysis of exactly this sort of thing that grand strategy and statecraft is born. They have to, leaders have to assess how they perceive the current state of affairs, where they want to move a country, and how other states will respond to what they would do. However, strategic intelligence production, as I've learned over the last year working with various intelligence organizations, is practiced more as an art of narrative construction than as a science of prediction. And I'm quite confident that policymaking is almost certainly even less bound by quantitative and methodological considerations, and is often driven, I think, to be fair, sometimes out of necessity, by reactionary pressures rather than by foresightful vision. So given my training as an experimental psychologist, as a behavioral scientist, I thought about this problem, this representation of the problem, in terms of analysis of variance, which is a statistical technique I often use in research. And I thought about it in terms of analysis of variance in three parts. First of all, analysis of variance in terms of our understanding of what is, which is the arrow to the left. So we could look at how agents, whether they're nation states or individual actors, what is the dispersion of their perceptions of reality. Secondly, we could conduct an analysis of variance in our expression of what ought to be. That is, to what extent do we want the same things? To what extent do we want to achieve the same things? And then finally, we can conduct an analysis of variance on that point of tension between those two arrows, which is to say, we could look at the variance in our is-ought discrepancies. That is, to what extent that discrepancy, the magnitude of that discrepancy, can be thought of in some sense as a measure of the motivation to change from the status quo. That is, if what you want to occur, the ought, is very different than the is, you'll presumably, if you're a rational agent, be more motivated to move in that direction. So it struck me that this type of analysis, which is not currently performed by intelligence organizations, or presumably in this sort of manner by policymakers, could be the basis for something which we might call principled strategy formulation. Okay, so that's the first part of my talk, and this is the part where I present something empirical to hedge my bets. And really, the second part of the talk could be summarized in this one slide, although I do have others in case I had extra time. So these are the results of a calibration study, a study of a division of intelligence analysts. They're strategic analysts that are making predictions for the highest level of decision makers, the Prime Minister's office, and senior policymakers within the Canadian government. So they're analysts within the Privy Council office. They're analysts from a division that focuses on the Middle East and Africa as the region of interest. And these judgments represent, in fact, a population of judgments that were collected over roughly a year and a half period. So these are not all the judgments that they made, but this is a representation of all of the predictive assessments, namely all of the forecasts that they made within that division. Fortunately for me, the director of this division makes his analysts assign numeric probabilities to their forecasts, which, and fortunately for me, he also follows up on their forecasts, even when they are a year in advance or a year into the future, and keeps track of whether they were accurate or inaccurate, which allows me to, in fact, calibrate their performance. So if you look at this calibration line, obviously if they were perfectly calibrated, well, for those who are not familiar with calibration, what this is showing is the relative frequency of event occurrence as a function of the subjective probability. Okay. And that's, for those of you who are not familiar with calibration, this is pretty good calibration. You don't usually see curves that are that good for experts. The calibration index ranges from 0 to 1, with 0 being perfect calibration, and they're very close, as you can see, to perfect calibration. They're also explaining 60% of the variance in the outcome measures, namely the events that they're trying to predict. And I'll stop there because I only have 8 minutes, but if you're asked, 8 seconds, right. 4, 3, 2, 1, thank you.
Assuming we can get the video to work.
Did you?
This should undershoot the 10-minute limit, because I found that many of the things that I wanted to say have in fact been said by other people. Tyler talked about the work I did with him, and Joe talked about the work that I did with him. And so I thought I'd compress myself to asking what I think is one big interesting question. And it's this: where is the equilibrium? Those of us who are involved in thinking about privacy are forever running helter-skelter to keep up. We're tracking a moving target. But we expect that sooner or later there will be some kind of societal equilibrium. And it would be really, really useful if from some discipline or other, from some place or another, we could get an insight into what that might look like. So here's the problem we face. Communications, computing, storage, and search keep on getting better and cheaper. And that's not going to stop anytime soon. We might have 10 years, 20 years in Moore's Law, we don't know. More and more industries are going to get like the software industry, which means that there will be tendencies to monopoly, there will be higher fixed costs, lower marginal costs, there will be all the factors which drive businesses to price discriminate. So the incentive to price discriminate goes up, the cost of price discrimination goes down, and this is not just business, this is government too. Governments would love to be able to sell every individual citizen their own policy, their own tax rate, at people's marginal willingness to pay and at people's marginal willingness to obey. So where is it going to stop? Well, 5 years ago I was involved in lobbying in Brussels against the IPR enforcement directive, and this taught me an interesting lesson. From the mid-1970s onwards, IPR, patents, copyrights, and so on, became worse and worse from the libertarian point of view. Enforcement was toughened up, copyright term was extended, international treaties were consolidated. This was driven by Big Pharma, by Hollywood, by the luxury goods industries, and a few other people who benefited from patents and copyright. It seemed unstoppable, but 5 years ago it started to run out of steam. And it wasn't because of fine words from Larry Lessig, and it certainly wasn't because of fine words from me. What actually happened is that a big, powerful lobby gets stopped in one of a couple of circumstances. First, it comes up against a big, powerful lobby that's pushing in the other direction. And what was happening in Brussels was that the supermarkets, the car parts makers, the telcos, and various other groups had got sufficiently fed up with the tax being on their lawn that they started to push back. So that's one of the things that can give rise to an equilibrium. Another is a political equilibrium, which I'll come to very shortly. Now, if you look at the workshop page, you'll see that I linked to a report called The Database State that Angela and I and four colleagues wrote and published in March. This is a survey of the big public sector databases that hold information about everybody in Britain, or at least about a very substantial minority of us. We examined and documented 46 databases. We came to the conclusion that 11 broke European human rights law, and that most of the rest has some question marks over them. Now, since then, there's been a bit of a kerfuffle, and one of the curious things I've noticed is that the public get upset about some of these databases, but not about others. Let me give you an example. There's a thing that's commonly known as the children's database. Its Sunday name is at Woman Contact Point. This gets everybody worked up. It's an address book for kids. It's got all the kids in Britain. It's got their names, addresses, phone numbers, who their GPs are, who their schools are, whether they are known to social work, which is potentially stigmatizing, so that's the focus of many of the objections. And also, if you're a celebrity, a politician, a rock star, a director of an intelligence agency, chief constable, somebody in witness protection, member of parliament, whatever, you can get your kids opted out. The press had a field day with that. So there's a very negative image, and both of the opposition parties have sworn that they will abolish this the day after the next election. There's another system, though, the population demographic system, which has got all this information and much more. And nobody gets worked up about it. This is our National Health Service's address book, so it's got for every child, and indeed for every adult, your name, address, your phone number, your password, so that you can phone up and get medical information about yourself over the phone, and an audit trail of all visits to physicians, not just who your GP is, but what days you went there, whether you went to the VD clinic, and if so, at precisely what moment you went up to the desk and registered. It's all there. No one cares. No one cares about PDS. Why should this be? Well, given what we've heard at the workshop, that's understandable enough. Privacy is about context. The first is a context of surveillance of kids, with exceptionalism from the famous. This is in the context of a health service that everybody's supposed to love and respect. So economics isn't going to be enough to figure out where the equilibrium will be, where the boundary will be of, between those systems that in the long run we will socially accept and those that in the long run we will keep on fighting until they are limited. And this brings me to the second kind of equilibrium that interests me. Political limits are sometimes established. Andrew Odlitsko has a link from the workshop page here to a paper that he wrote, which points out that there's a perpetual tension between economic efficiency on the one hand and fairness on the other, and that has led to long-term dispensations such as railway regulation in the 1870s. People got fed up with the price discrimination in America and in Europe, and the result was regulation on what fares you could charge. So it's perhaps a reasonable guesstimate that privacy will end up being regulated, and there will no doubt be a long tussle of 20 or 30 or 50 years before we get to the place where the railways were in the 1870s. Now here's the big question. What sort of forces are going to determine where the boundary lies? And what can we really do to nudge the eventual location of that boundary one way or another? So I'm not talking about tactical stuff that we do today, be rude to this politician and shout about that encryption scheme and blah, blah, blah. Where is this going in the long term? How do we understand it? How do we conceptualize it? And as once we started to understand it, is there anything useful that we can do about it?
Alma, you're up.
Is the buzzword issue. And I think I can probably go faster without doing it. And we're obviously fixed, set for time here. The title of this session is How Do We Fix the World? And I've been working on that a long time, and my conclusion is give up. I noticed that this title probably came from Bruce, and I noticed he also didn't put himself on the panel.
It was last year's.
We haven't fixed it yet. It'll be on next year.
We didn't edit the schedule from last year. We were too lazy.
Okay. Anything fits, anything. Well, I'd like to actually take off on a phrase that Alma used, which is, tell me the threat that that's designed to protect against, and apply it basically to terrorism, and make a few points, and then argue a little bit about what's happening with DHS and so forth, and the way I think that the world should more or less potentially go, but it won't. Terrorism is not a threat as far as I can see. I don't want any, it's a problem, it's a concern, maybe, but it seems to me that using the word threat, even though it's obviously a semantic issue, is basically too extreme. Al-Qaeda, essentially, which is the only terrorist group that wants to attack the United States, so therefore, presumably, and for that matter, North America, Western Europe, consists of maybe 150 people, maybe 200 running around the hills of Pakistan trying to not be bombed by cruise missiles. It has been almost totally discredited within the Muslim world. It was always a fringe group of a fringe group, and now it's basically a joke in many respects. Since 9/11, as far as I can see, Al-Qaeda has done nothing except issue statements. There's been no Al-Qaeda operations, real operations, which they really put together, as far as I can see, since 9/11. Though there may have been a few that, you know, they're sort of connected to or associated with, or what's the buzzword of connected to, I guess, is sometimes intelligence people use, but it seems to be very attenuated. The total amount, and beyond that, if you deal with, so that's Al-Qaeda Central, 150 people or something. Then beyond that, there's a bunch of people around the world who might actually blow something up. They're sort of on the same wavelength in some ways. Overwhelmingly, these seem to be spectacularly incompetent and stupid. There's an increasing number of people interviewing police people, both in this country and in Europe. And these guys are basically flaky or incompetent. That doesn't mean they can't do some damage sometime. But one example, is a guy caught in Rockford, Illinois, who was an FBI informant, basically cajoled him into buying some hand grenades, which he's going to set off in a mall in Rockford, Illinois. And his idea basically was put the hand grenades, the terrorist idea, put the hand grenades in a garbage can to increase the amount of shrapnel. Well, a hand grenade is shrapnel. I mean, that's the reason there's all those pieces on it. So you put it in a garbage can, it's going to muffle the effect of it. Essentially, my son suggests it's like trying to kill somebody by shooting through a board and hoping they'll be impaled by the splinters. So I mean, it's basically that level of thing. These guys, you know, if he had gotten a real hand grenade rather than a phony hand grenade from the FBI, he might have set it off in a shopping mall and some people would have been killed and so forth. So I don't mean there's no problem. But that's not exactly an existential threat, which is what it's constantly being labeled as. And the total amount of violence committed by Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda wannabes, Al-Qaeda maybes, Al-Qaeda lookalikes, whatever, since 9/11, outside of war zones, comes to be about 200 or 300 people per year in the whole world outside of war zones, maybe 400 or something. But obviously, again, not something I'd call a threat. I mean, obviously, it's tragic these people were killed and so forth in London and Bali and Madrid and so forth. But it's not a cosmic threat, or even the word threat is being used. Anyway, that's my first point. That's what the danger seems to be, and it's massively inflated, and as far as I can see, increasingly so. My second point basically has to do with what's happening with the terrorism issue, and it seems to me it's become there's a technical Washington phrase. It's become a self-licking ice cream cone. Which I really like that phrase because it doesn't mean anything, but it's really vivid and sort of vulgar too. So I like that. It's sort of like a bat out of hell. You know, it's a brilliant phrase, but the question is, what does it mean? Why are there bats in hell? If you think about it, it doesn't make much sense. But anyway, it's a self-licking ice cream cone. In other words, it's going to go on forever. So if you're into getting money from the Department of Homeland Security, it'll be there with a $60 or $70 billion budget probably for a very long time, no matter who's in office. I did an article, which is on the web thing here, called Terror Phobia, about that. And it just seems to me that it's just going to keep going on. It's basically, even though the threat doesn't seem to be there, even though an increasing number of people are saying, well, Al-Qaeda sort of washed up and so forth, not everybody says that, but some increasing number of people say it. Nonetheless, I think we can keep perpetuating it. My comparison is with communists during the Cold War, domestic communists in the United States, in which there was a few cases which caused people to become concerned about it. 20, 30 years later, when American communists were hardly rose to the level of being a joke, the FBI was still sifting through their garbage and spending money trying to protect the country against them. And I think that's what's happening with the war on terror, as it's happening, for example, in the war on drugs, which has equally a kind of an effect. Okay, so that's my second point, basically, is it's likely to be here forever, even despite what happens with what I consider to be reality. Since my time is very brief, I'd just like to talk about a couple of projects I've been working on. I did this book called Overblown in 2006, making the argument that I've been making so far, that we much exaggerated the threat, and I think it's even more so the case now. And people asked me basically two things on that repeatedly when I gave talks on it. The people who agreed with me and most amazingly, large number of people did, surprisingly. One was, what if they get nuclear weapons? And the other was, what do you specifically propose for policy? Well, I did deal with nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction and so forth. By the way, hand grenades are technically weapons of mass destruction, as are the bombs bursting in air, according to, so that's why Francis Scott Key was so impressed. The bombs bursting in air were WMD. But anyway, I did have a section in the book on that, and I've now done another book, which deals with it much more in detail, which will be out in October, called Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda. The other area, something I've been working on and also working with Mark Stewart on, is sort of trying to come up with really specific policy proposals. And I'd like to run through quickly, what's my time here? Okay, yeah, extremely quickly. One thing about the question about protecting, and it seems to be these are the kinds of questions that should be there if you're trying to protect against terrorism. There's various problems. One is, there's virtually infinite number of targets, yeah, particularly if your population is if you're trying to kill people. This room is a perfectly good target. Secondly, the probability, which almost rarely gets mentioned, the probability of any specific target being attacked is virtually zero. Maybe it is zero in many respects. Thirdly, terrorists are effectively, judging from what we know about them, effectively random when they pick a target. Basically the reason the Glasgow airport was targeted is because the guy had to live next to it. I mean, it wasn't totally random. It's just they're opportunistic. And these guys got this idea, and they said, let's blow something up. Well, there's Glasgow, there's the airport, I know where it is, so let's blow it up. So effectively, that's random from the standpoint of a policing situation, unless you can really get totally inside their minds, obviously. There's also a displacement effect. Basically, if you protect one target, it makes other targets less safe. So, for example, there's an article in the Washington Post about 2 years ago about how they're having a lot of biosensors in New York City. And there's all kinds of things about would they work and not like that and so forth. And so I wrote the guy, the Washington Post reporter, and I said, well, you know, if you make biosensors really work in New York, then the terrorists are more likely to set off biological bombs or whatever it is in Washington, right? So what's the gain? And he said, boy, that's pretty interesting. I'll have to look into that. So far he hasn't. I've been following his work carefully. So basically, you got the displacement effect. Even if you are able to protect the target somewhat, he can find another target because there's so many of them. If we protect this room, then they'll go out and blow up, and you know, out there and so forth. So consequently, predicting anything is very difficult. It's also the case that most targets are vulnerable in one sense, physical targets, in that you can blow them up, but they're also invulnerable in the sense that they can mostly be rebuilt fairly cheaply. Even the Pentagon, which is very horribly damaged, of course, could get repaired at a tolerable cost. So consequently, the idea that something's vulnerable is questionable if it can be repaired at a reasonable cost. The World Trade Center, obviously, is something different, and killing people, obviously, you can't repair them. But many targets are that situation. And there's also the problem that it's probably the case, and no one is willing to admit this, that's a minute or 13 seconds, yeah, okay. That some targets are simply that can't be protected. The London Underground is a good case in point. It was attacked on 7/7/2005, and was already fairly well protected because of the IRA and so forth. The Underground has more cops per inch than a lot of targets. But then basically what happened was it was much more protected after that. 2 weeks later, several guys got on the bombs. Turns out the bombs didn't work, but obviously they were able to get in. So the idea of even trying to protect something like that is fundamentally hopeless. And then finally, just one final point is that some targets may not, if you're going to really protect some targets, you ought to consider whether the target is one you'd really want to protect, given other concerns. For example, airports. Why would you want to protect airports as opposed to other places of congregation? It, not airplanes, but airports. Well, airports are basically lousy targets. Good targets to have. If terrorists are going to blow something up, you'd want them to blow up the airport because people tend to be dispersed. They're only two or three stories high. if they do some damage, you can easily route people around them, around the damaged areas, and basically continue the business of the airport. So therefore, compared to other targets, airports are basically something you'd want to spend less money on if you're really worried about this kind of eventuality. Okay, thanks.
On your list?
All right.
Well, you said, I reminded of the story of a terrorist in Germany who had a bomb and was going to attack some government building and got on the bus in the wrong direction and was wondering what to do, saw a synagogue, decided to get off and bomb the synagogue, and it was billed as this huge anti-Semitic uprising in Germany when, in fact, there was just a guy getting on the wrong bus.
So it's a struggle to figure out after a workshop like this what to say that hasn't been said, and Ross even said that. but I look to the title of the session and say, how do we fix security and human behavior? And fixing something requires having some degree of agreement on what's actually wrong. And it's really easy. We've heard an awful lot of things that are wrong. We've heard a lot of places where security isn't working, where people aren't behaving in the way we might like them to, and we've heard all sorts of ways in which things are wrong, and that makes it easy to think that we actually have a pretty good handle on what's wrong. And I'd like to argue that we don't. That when we set out to actually engineer secure systems, and this is my day job, is helping Microsoft engineer secure systems, figuring out the prioritization of what we should work on first is tremendously difficult. That we don't know if more systems are broken into because of an O-day. We actually have some information on that, and it's not O-day, but is it unpatched systems? Is it failure to configure? Is it authentication failure? Is it that big group of human error? Which of these lead to more break-ins? Which of these lead to more loss of control over information? Which of the incidents which occur have the greatest damage, either to the institution that held the data, or as an externality to others? We lack information about all of these things, and I'd like to argue that the reason we lack information about all of these things is actually shame. It's shame about talking about our failures. We don't like to talk about what goes wrong, and in not talking about what goes wrong, we are inhibiting our ability to move forward for all sorts of problems around security. It prevents us from being empirical, and if we knew what went wrong, then we could use that to direct our research. We could use it to direct our investments. We could use it to think about better ways. We've had a couple of people talk. Angela talked about compliance budgets. Diana talked about how we actually select what we want to teach people. Knowing what we want to teach people is not a matter of expert opinion as much as it is what are the problems we'd like them to not experience. If we knew that, we could change our education methods and perhaps they would be substantially more effective because we'd be educating people about the right thing. But we don't want to talk about it. Now, we have lots of excuses. You're going to get sued. your customers will all flee, your stock price will collapse. We know these are actually all false, partially because of people in this room who have done empirical research into these things, that customers don't flee. Alessandro did work on stock prices. And so all of these excuses, all of these beliefs which we have, are expressions which people put forward to avoid saying, I'm ashamed of my failure. I've administered a whole bunch of systems. Almost all of them have been broken into.
Is this now a 12-step group you're starting?
No, it's not a 12-step group. I'm owning up to it, but nobody likes to. How often do people admit to that? You know, you're shocked to hear me do it. You make a joke because it's uncomfortable. It's embarrassing. And at a workshop on human behavior, I want to say that this embarrassment, it's a very natural thing to feel, to believe, is something which holds us back from doing the sort of research we might like to do. When Mark Stewart was presenting his equations about cost and expected loss, we have data for neither side of those equations, cost and expected frequency. We don't have data for those equations in information security because we don't want to talk about what's happening. And so those are very nice equations, which if only we could plug something into one side or the other, they might give us something relating to reality. But we don't have it. I believe that we need something like the National Transportation Safety Board, where if you go and you present information, if you have an incident involving your operation of an aircraft, either one that leads to injury or near injury, you report it, and it's made available for research. And as we heard, in 2007 and 2008, there were no incidents in which people died in the United States in aviation. We can't say anything close to that about security. I was recently in South Africa. I've been looking into truth and reconciliation as a possible model, that after the horrors of apartheid, people came forward and said, this is what happened. A commission of the great and the good analyzed it. They put forth a report. Perhaps that's something that we in computer security could learn from. But I think that if we actually want to ask the question of how are we going to fix the world, we need to understand what is wrong. And in order to understand what is wrong, we're going to need to address the shame that we feel in talking about. Thank you.
Questions, discussion? This is your last chance to come up with, please.
Is there any evidence that computer security has a worse job of admitting that we're wrong than any other field?
Is there any evidence that we do a worse job of admitting that we're wrong?
Bankers obviously have made some mistakes.
So I looked to the outcome of what happened to ChoicePoint, which is that ChoicePoint announced that 30-odd thousand Californians had a problem with data that ChoicePoint stored about them. And then it turned, and they told people in California because of a law. And then people realized that no other state had these laws, and they very quickly acquired those laws. And all of a sudden, we're getting hundreds of disclosures a year that we actually are having problems that are impacting people's personal information. I think it's reasonable to extrapolate that many failures don't involve personal information, so we never hear about them. But the minute we've required people to talk about failures, boy, it's been a floodgate.
Terrence,
I've got a question for John Miller. Your interesting remarks. I'm prompted to be reminded of that. I couldn't get a monograph published for someone I was supervising. Institute I was working at, because his case was about that terrorism did not have a strategic impact. And that was his whole argument was about that. It was impossible to get it published, even on my own institute and elsewhere. I just wonder if you could reflect on, one of the most important components of those who conduct terrorism is having an impact on public perception, and particularly targeting democratic countries in particular. And so it's not so much the number of people being killed. It, what matters is the impact on public perception and then the impact on policy. If you look at the anthrax incident in Washington, 5 people killed, tragic for those 5. I don't want to minimize that, be misunderstood. But the huge impact was remarkable in terms of, as I think we had a private conversation about, as it being a weapon of mass disruption. But therefore, perhaps in making your argument, I mean, how do you counter that argument? I mean, you could make a case that it does have strategic impact for these kinds of reasons.
No, I don't. I don't counter it. I agree with it. Overblownly, my argument is that the problem has not been what the terrorists do, but what we do to ourselves in reaction, including the Iraq War, for example, which has resulted in far more deaths of Americans, much less Iraqis and so forth, than were killed in 9/11. And so the problem is basically, in my view, is that what public officials should be doing, and the press and other people, members of what I call the terrorism industry, should be doing, is trying to put these things in context. So, for example, when the Department of Homeland Security says right on its first page of the manifesto, a terrorist could strike at any time, any place, anywhere with virtually any weapon, a statement which is at least somewhat true, the next statement said, however, your chances of being killed by an international terrorist over an 80-year period are 1 in 80,000. In that case, it would be in some sort of context, the kind of things that Dan Gardner says should happen, but it's not there. And so what we've had basically is the president and everybody else on down, as well as the press, basically exacerbating the threat and therefore enhancing the fear. And it seems to me that's the major problem. So the problem is that the enemy is us. And so consequently, terrorists do have a big impact, but it's not because of what they do. Osama bin Laden said that specifically. You know, we do this and they come running around, they bankrupt the United States by trying to fight wars in far off areas and so forth. And so the problem is at that level, and I don't see that changing very much. We still got
Chris.
Yeah. So Chris Segoia in Brooklyn Center. I would like users to do the right thing. I think part of the way of getting them to do that is for them to realize what's going on. So this question is actually for both Adam and Alma. So Microsoft's search engine log policy is after 18 months. The entire IP address and all the cookies and all identifiable information is stripped off. And Microsoft tells users, we anonymize your logs after 18 months. With Google, after 18 months, the last 8 bits of the IP address are deleted, and at 9 months, some smaller bit are deleted and the cookies are left alone. And Google tells its customers, we anonymize your logs. So both companies are saying the same thing to users, when in fact the anonymity provided to users is drastically different. So the question to both of you is, how can we expect users to make the right decision with regard to the data they trust to your companies when they have no real way of judging what's being done?
Anyone?
Do you want to start?
I would start by saying that while we use the word anonymize, we also say in detail exactly what it is that we do so that information is available.
So
do you expect users to understand that information?
Let him do it.
Oh. I think the question of anonymization, and for those of you who don't know, I spent 3 years working at Zero Knowledge, where I spent a lot of energy trying to help users understand various aspects of what technical privacy protections meant to them. And I think that, you know, both of our companies do our best to explain what it is we're doing, and figuring out where in the hierarchy of threats about which an end user should care, these questions of anonymization come in. I'm not sure where it fits on that stack.
So, yeah. I mean, to make this more general, the question is, I mean, it's always the balance of how we give the users information, yet they don't have the ability to make decisions based on that information.
I would bring that to the question. We have a choice. We can either provide only the information that all users can understand, or we can provide the technical details that they can go to their experts like Bruce and find out, and hopefully those experts help them Would you prefer that these companies not provide the information that users can't understand, but that would allow their technical experts to give them the best advice, the third parties, because you may not trust Microsoft or Google to find what's anonymous, or should we just not give out that information? It seems to me that it's better to give out that information, even if not all users will be able to understand.
We'll remind of the technical crap button.
The technical crap that you should talk to Bruce about.
Great.
And here's his cell phone number.
Anonymization is a really big, very much bigger deal than some of the policy areas I'm concerned about. Now, I can and I do browse Google, use Google anonymously by going through Tor with a different browser. Anybody who can be bothered can do that. But I don't have the option of getting medical treatment in the UK without details of that treatment being put in a database called the NHS Secondary Uses Service, which is supposedly anonymized because, you know, there's an encrypted NHS number there instead of a name and address. But if you've got a whole lot of records pertaining to one person and you know just a little bit about that person, you can put out that record. So there are many, many people who are relying on anonymization to give security theater where it's not, in fact, practical to protect information with that kind of architecture.
So my stack is now 4 high.
So the issue there about whether Google and Microsoft are doing different things and whether they're saying the same thing reminds me of the discussion of Luke's presentation about criticizing Facebook for what they do and saying, well, Facebook obviously doesn't care about users' privacy. But actually, can we say that? Because we can't even in this room say to them, what should you do for users' privacy and how should you present this information? So I think the criticism is a little at a level where what we should be saying is, are you working together and with other players to define common standards in these areas and to define good explanations for the public that people like Bruce can put out into the general flow of information that the public will understand so that they know what they're getting into on a relatively simple level. I mean, some of this is about, yes, you're not getting the same things done, so that you don't have this complexity level of, well, is that the same as that? But we've got to work together to get these standards set up, and then we can complain about companies which aren't abiding by the standards or which are pulling all over people's eyes, whether deliberately or inadvertently.
Joe, is my next person in the queue?
Sorry, Luke.
Yeah, Luke, sorry.
I'm on a separate topic, so if someone else wants to continue this. So, Ross, there seems to have been an assumption in a lot of the social studies of technology that there's going to be a kind of continuous negotiation process that will go on forever, basically. As new technologies get adopted, beliefs as to what we want will shift. I'd be interested in understanding what you meant then by we're kind of heading to an equilibrium and how we would know whether we were doing or whether we weren't doing.
Well, there's an interesting paper in this by Andrew Odlisko, who unfortunately left. During the early 19th century, price discrimination in railways was extreme because, as with information goods nowadays, you've got very high fixed costs and variable marginal costs. And people got really fed up with differences between first class and fifth class prices being two orders of magnitude and different ticket prices on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Fridays and Easter. And basically all over the developed world, governments brought in regulations saying, for example, in Britain, I think it was a first class ticket was only 150% of the price of a second class ticket. And that, if you like, stilled all the social ructions, but at the cost of growing inefficiency, because if you look at the efficiency of the railways, it had improved up until the 1870s, and it then declined up until World War II. So you do get phase shifts like this in technology, and it's just about conceivable that at some time in the next 20 or 30 years, there will be an 1870 moment with privacy. You can imagine an international convention where America gets together with European Union privacy commissioners and some other big players and says, right, we will have a global privacy law, and it will say
we need a privacy commissioner first.
And if that is in the future, it's certainly not possible, then what would the shape of that be? Where would the bumps be? Would you have special provisions for things like healthcare that relate to the body and activate, you know, certain heuristics and biases? Or would you try and look at it in terms of the financial effects of discrimination or what, the point that I was making is that this isn't a question that can be answered solely with reference to economics. So it's not like regulating the railways. It's tougher, it's more complex, and it involves this community.
John is next to Mike here.
A question linking Ross's question, where will it end, with your invoking the science fiction writers in the first session. A few years ago, I was invited to speak to a conference of science fiction writers, some of whom had been published. It was quite a geeky affair. My theme was the social consequences of hypermobility. And I was noting the year-on-year-on-year increase in physical mobility. In 1950, the average Brit traveled 5 miles a day. Now it's over 30, forecast to be over 60 in 2025. And then the later trends of increasing electronic mobility, growing very much faster. And essentially, my theme was very similar to that in Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone, that these trends are reducing social capital. Every year, fewer people can attach a name to their next door neighbor. We are increasingly living in an anonymous world. The perceived scale of problems that need governing is increasing year on year. And so in Britain, to take the example I was using, power and responsibility and authority have been migrating from Town Hall to Whitehall to Brussels and ultimately to completely unaccountable organizations like the World Trade Organization, which nobody votes for. And so my question was, can anyone give me an example of a genuine democracy from the genre of science fiction in which distance has been conquered by science and technology? And nobody could. From Brave New World and 1984 to Star Wars and Blade Runner, the form of government is invariably tyrannical hierarchy. The scale of problems that need governing renders democracy, as we would recognize it, impossible. And so the demand for the database state, if you're supposedly governing this anonymous mob, you crave information about them. The form of policing perhaps needs to be either Orwellian or simply impotent.
I'll take reactions to that.
Are there sci-fi writers who are producing any example of what a good democracy could look like?
Not
in the story. Well, that's right. It's not compelling if everyone just goes back, you know, to the Grecian Athenian model of.
The challenge was of the genre of science fiction in which distance had been conquered by science.
And I guess, regardless of distance, is there anyone who's actually thinking of what does good governance in
democracy? There is a group of. I mean, there are essays reimagining democracy in the information age. I mean, with the notion that constitutional democracy like we have in the United States or in the UK is sort of the best thing that mid-18th century technology can build. The idea is that you have to elect one legislator and send him far away because communication and travel is expensive. And so there are people who are writing essays about what happens when that changes.
And there is social science to this. So on one hand, you have cast unseen research shows that if you have deliberation, people get more and more entrenched in their positions. Of course, he did a ridiculous experiment, which is he took people who already agreed with each other. Already agreed with each other and found out that when you put them in a room, they agree with each other even more.
He also found out that when you mix people of moderate but opposing views,
yes.
they do tend to come together more.
And he didn't talk about that. That's not on his book tours, and that's also work that's been built over and over again by a bunch of people who found that you can do that remotely as well as just in the same room. So you can actually, in terms of building consensus, you can use technology to increase that. And Wellman's group up at Toronto has pointed out that Putnam completely didn't get information technology, that in fact you can build lots of wonderful social capital through information technology.
Yeah.
Yeah, can I just point out the rather, I think, obvious correlation that over the last century, as mobility and communications advanced at a galloping rate, so did democracy.
I also have this concept of hypomobility, not enough, hypermobility too much. So you can project your rising graph, which disappears off the top of the page. You can project it back into the pedestrian peasant economy, which I would find claustrophobic and horrible. But my mind boggles as the graph disappears off the top of the page. I assume, I don't know exactly where it is, but somewhere between these extremes, I imagine there's something better than either extreme.
Can I just ask a quick question?
No,
we're
staying on the topic right now.
So a narrow answer and then a little bit broader. I believe Robert Heinlein's Double Star concerns a future democracy and the election of a president in it. But I think going back to some of what you were saying earlier, there are lots of science fiction stories which don't touch on the form of government at all. And I suspect that many of those, there's probably references to it being democratic in some vague form, but it's simply not an interesting part of the story and therefore not touched on. All of the interesting stories are ones in which things are broken and thus conflict exists.
Please. Yeah, actually, Cass Sunstein has done some work. He keeps being invited to this conference and never shows up, but basically arguing
that. Yeah.
Well, he had one before, he paid better probably. The basically people tend to aggregate like-mindedness, so that basically when you have leftists, they tend to pick out other leftists, and it's an argument essentially against the freedom of association. But essentially now, when you've got sort of generic newspapers, for example, and you buy a newspaper, you can't, if you buy the New York Times, you have to see columns by both left and right wing people. But with the information age, and you can pick your own sort of bailiwick, it may be that people will be more and more into these extremist, relatively extremist corners. That won't necessarily be undemocratic. It'll just be that people are more only talk to people they agree with.
It's US talk radio.
It's what? Yeah, that's right. That's right. Then that's happening. People
but some of that is that where communities used to be based on geography, you were stuck with who you were living next to. If communities are based on choice, you could choose people who think like you much more easily. You couldn't get a
and this
town.
This accelerates that issue.
But in the, that may be the case in the USA, but in the UK, political bloggers link to people of other parties because the penny has dropped. But if you want lots of people to come to your blog, you've got to link to lots of other people's blogs. So you have to be generous, otherwise you end up being a hermit.
The United States tends to
wirelessly link. You have to say this person had a good idea, or can you mock them in linking? Is that
well, you can do both. You give praise where praise is due, and put the boot in where the boot is due.
Is there a good date on that? Because Eitan Adar and Elad Adamek basically found that was not true in the U.S., but I don't know.
The U.S. policy is far more.
I respect that, but I just have some data. Data when it came out with
Lada
and
Eitan
really shocked a lot of people. Was really.
So
I'm wondering if there's actually, if you have data on this that you can share.
Top letter we can see
what
we can dig up.
Dan,
it's
my next.
Okay, I just want to ask about the analyst predictions. Did you also
this new topic, yes.
The analyst predictions. The chart, I just want to ask to clarify now when the line wavers below a perfect prediction and then goes above. This is underconfidence and overconfidence, is that right?
They're actually they're underconfident. They're it's almost the inversion of what you would typically get from a calibration study if you open up any journal in forecasting, with the exception of certain areas of expert forecasting. But by and large, the what has seeped out of behavioral decision theory into the broader public consciousness is that people are overconfident. And these results actually suggest that analysts are underconfident, and I have evidence from a couple of classes that I've gone into where I train analysts that they do differ from the general population, and that, for example, in Bayesian reasoning, their deviations from Bayesian probabilities reflect underestimates of the Bayesian values. And the effect of my training is to mitigate the effect of or the magnitude of underconfidence in analysts.
And were there correlates of greater accuracy that you were about to get to, which you ran out of time? Did I see that?
The last slide, the last table, which I ran out of time, was addressing, the question that always arises when I present this to intelligence directors or trainers is, well, why are they so good? we always hear about experts being bad. Phil Tetlock has a book on expert political judgment that suggests that experts are not that good. So why are these experts so good? And they're not only good in terms of calibration, they're good in terms of overall classification. I didn't get a chance to show you that either, but they correctly classified 90% of the judgments that they made, and it was 94% correct classification rate for occurrences and 84% for non-occurrences. So a pretty good record. I mean, the last slide showed their calibration results and discrimination results broken down by the experience of the analyst, which had no effect. Calibration was exactly the same for junior analysts and for senior analysts. The importance of the judgment for policy. So this was rated not by the analyst, but by the director and a senior analyst from another division. They rated each of those 580 judgments in terms of whether they had high policy relevance or lower, relatively lower policy relevance. Again, no effect on calibration. So that hypothesis we were able to rule out. Because, of course, one argument is that if analysts are always making judgments about easy things, well, then that's why they're looking so good. The last factor that I put up was data on the difficulty of the judgment. And this was both assessed by the analyst who made the judgment as well as by the director. There was, as you would expect, some decrement in calibration as a function of increasing difficulty of the judgment. But, I mean, even for highly complex judgments, which there were only, I think, 62 out of those that were categorized as highly complex, calibration index was 0.05, which is still extremely high calibration. So this is not the only group of experts that show good calibration. I mean, meteorologists, if you look at data from expert forecasters and weather forecasters for probability of precipitation, their estimates are almost right on the calibration line. Bridge players as well are pretty good.
He means the game, not the infrastructure.
That's right.
Other topics? Other questions?
If I may, one more. Adam, have you come across James Whittaker in your time at Microsoft?
Yes.
Right. So his book Tales thing, he encourages this kind of telling community stories about what weird behavior you found in a piece of application, an application that you're investigating attacking. The results that he was claiming, that he was attributing to this Blood Tales process, were very impressive, I thought. And it sounds like the same kind of thing that you're advocating, of kind of getting over the shame of having found these problems?
Which of James's work? Or?
So this was a talk he gave in NSR at Cambridge a couple of years ago, I guess. He said that the consultancy he used to run essentially succeeded as well as it did because of this process of telling tales about weirdnesses of software.
Okay.
If he hasn't talked about it to you since then.
I haven't heard about it. In general, we have a tremendous amount of folklore within the information security industry, and a lot of it is good. But it's very hard to judge which of it is good and which of it is leading us down mistaken paths.
Do you have any suggestions for what areas beyond breach disclosures might be useful for discussion? And what might be practical in convincing people?
What areas would be useful and practical?
Software development practices.
I think software development practices are a very interesting one. Gary McGraw and Brian Chest just did a report on building security and maturity models. I'd very much like to get operational data. I think that the closer we are to the people who are actually operating the systems and which are failing, it's relatively easy to do work on software development. It's very, very hard to do work on operations because there's usually cross-organizational issues, there's usually all sorts of fear, and there's usually all sorts of shame. But just as a general principle, I encourage people to ask, how much data do we really have, and how much more could we have if we were willing to talk to each other?
Follow up on that piece. There's quite a bit of work, I believe, in the healthcare community about no-fault disclosure. I mean, you talked about national transportation safety boards, et cetera, but I think actually within the... that's a big thing, and it's a large industry, but it's not about individual people, whereas in healthcare, it's about individual people, but it can indicate systemic failures. So it might be worth looking into how these no-fault policies have been introduced and work.
I haven't heard about that. I'd love to get more detail from you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So just to go back to the anonymity question for a little while, both heard Paul talk about this and also LaTanya about why using the term anonymous data is bad, because it implies a state. It is either anonymous or non-anonymous, and we need to start using language of relatively de-identified. Just speaking in those terms, and we don't have too much in terms of language. I know a number of people here are big fans of George Lakoff, but we sort of, if we're going to try to move towards policy that reflects human behavior, we need to start coming up with vocabulary that can reflect this and not make people think of pure good states and bad states.
Well, I suppose my experience with healthcare gives me a certain view, in that many, many people who have built bad healthcare systems have relied on removing patient names, even although they would admit when pressed. But of course, this gave you only the shallowest of privacy protections. So I suppose at the most fundamental level, my objection to anonymization is this, that first, when Dorothy Denning and others explored this 30 years ago, they realized it was almost undoable except in very specific, well-defined applications. And second, it still keeps on being used dishonestly as security theater by people who can't be bothered to design and architect the systems properly.
I think we've learned that the more we learn about anonymity, the harder it is. We see again and again how easy it is to de-anonymize data. And
33 bits of entropy, right?
But it's worse than that. Picking out people from their movie preferences, or picking up people from an anonymous AOL search data, that this turns out to be an extremely difficult problem. And there's not a lot of research in the academic community.
If you'd like,
anonymity.
Actually, so August 6th through 9th in Seattle, I'm general chair for the Privacy Enhancing Technology Symposium, and would invite you all to come on up.
Well,
you could register anonymously.
And another thing, of course, is that as more and more systems become social, then anonymity will rapidly move from being usually impossible to being the absolutely impossible, because once you have a few motifs, a few patterns of friendships, well, hey, game over. Tilt.
Yeah. I've got a question about how Google can possibly, or any search company, possibly know what is anonymous. So clearly your IP address, you can get rid of that, and then you can get rid of, time and all that. But even the information that's left is, how can Google know? If you have, that AOL leak, I Google something, and then I Google my name, and they've got the same idea, that's probably useful information, even if you don't provide that information. If I Google things together, or if I search for something where even the fact that somebody knows about this reveals something, let's say there's something that only two people in the world are supposed to know about, and then I Google for it, clearly that information should be anonymous. It seems to me that it's basically impossible, because Google or any search company can't know what's anonymous, or what needs to be anonymous.
So, I think what you were saying really speaks to that challenge, because anonymity isn't a binary, right? And one of the things that's frustrating to me in working on privacy as somebody who came out of very much the security background is that in security there's a very accepted discourse of threat modeling. Some people do it more formally than others, but you very naturally have the conversation where you say, you don't claim that something is secure or not in a binary way. I mean, everybody gets past that very quickly. You're saying that this is secure against this situation, this kind of attacker, this kind of resources, this kind of motivation. And when we're talking about whether something is in to expand the discussion to talk about that. So when I was talking, I evoked sort of the starter example of the utility company where I give them my name and address and all of this. That's one end of the spectrum, right? I mean, there isn't any question about how hard it would be, what kind of effort it would take to link that to me in the real world. It's very, very direct. When you get more toward, for example, the AOL example, that took New York Times reporters putting significant, expensive human forensic effort into tracking that down. Now, there are certainly threat scenarios where that could well be your threat, but it's a different place on the spectrum than the utility company databases. And the other part, again, to go back to my talk, when we're talking about that spectrum, we want to get users as full information as possible about the costs and benefits. Because if you push the dial all the way to the other end of that spectrum, and you say that your old colleague from Zero Knowledge used the example of the all-powerful space alien, I think, right? If you're trying to protect against the all-powerful space aliens, you have to push the dial all the way to the other end, where anything that somebody with extreme amounts of resources and focus and motivation could potentially link to somebody in the outside world. And Google no longer exists.
Well, I've perhaps got a relevant example. I think 4 or 5 years ago, there was a two-bit group that some people would call terrorists, animal rights fundamentalists, started harassing a number of us in the university because we were planning to build a monkey house. And the techniques were moderately unpleasant. They'd turn up at 3 a.m. and throw firecrackers onto your roof and put paint stripper on your cars and stuff. And so for a period of a few months, it was in my interest to see to it that my domestic address couldn't be found easily through Google. This is slightly harder than you might think, and it's not the sort of security policy we could reasonably expect Google to provide for. But it's an example of the sort of unexpected thing that will come up in the information age, that you can't really predict in advance, and you just have to hack as best you can when it happens.
So I'm kind of looking for last comments.
Well, I was going to put a question to everybody else. Listening to John's presentation, I'm even more impressed than having read the book. I found him absolutely convincing. I have no difficulty, wherever I try it, getting a laugh from my examples of terrorism paranoia, and yet laughs are all we get. Nothing seems to change. Why? Can anyone help us?
All right, in 15 seconds, who can answer that?
Incentives, right? I mean, if I'm the government official in charge of harassing citizens to protect them against terrorism, I can, acknowledge that what I'm doing is silly, and if proven wrong, I pay an infinite price. And if I'm right, I lose my job. So,
it's a self-perpetuating thing. Self-licking ice cream cone. It just keeps going on and on. No one evaluates the war on drugs.
Where does self-licking ice cream cone come from? I want to use it, but I want to.
It's on the web. I checked it. I came up with Richard.
You can buy that at Baskin Robbins.
I've perhaps got a somewhat more optimistic viewpoint, at least from the point of view of a Brit, which is when you look at the various heuristics and biases that make terrorism work, and we've been discussing them all for the last couple of days, they are pretty well known to behavioral economists, and they're also known to people who study things like how people behave in auctions. Now, the first time you go to Sotheby's, you'll be a victim of Winner's Curse, but by the 10th time you go there, you'll be a grizzled old professional antiques dealer. Why? Because most of these heuristics and biases are at their strongest in circumstances where we are dealing with something for the first time, and we learn to deal with them as we get more experience. This is one of the reasons why Britain's response to the 7/7 bombings was very much more laid back than the American response to 9/11. Right? The Irish have been blowing us up for 300 years, and it's absolutely routine, in Britain to be blown up.
just
not So you know, with time and practice, and the terrorist ghost will gradually fade away.
So before we close, and after this, so we're going to go upstairs to the fourth floor to the place in the building where there is a liquor license, and have an after-conference reception. Russ, you want to talk a bit about the plans for next year?
Okay, well, the plan is to have a workshop next year. Like this, we are probably getting to the point where we have to change the format slightly. Last year we had 40-ish people, and so we had panels of 4 or 5, and now we've got 50-ish people, so we've got panels of 5 or 6, and that doesn't scale particularly well, so we first of all have to think what it's going to look like. We probably want to have a number of panels, and we have to think what they should be on. We may also want to have some reference paper tracks so that students have been doing relevant work can get the kudos of having these papers published. So there's a format question. How do we grow the workshop and in what directions? I'm sure we want to keep it a highly interactive workshop, and we want to continue to bring psychologists, security engineers, and other interested people together. But there's a question then of how we build a research program in the community. And you know, we'll discuss these things by email, I'm sure, over the next few months. The second thing is location and timing. We're thinking that it might be a good idea to have it on the other side of the Atlantic next year. There's a number of psychologists in the UK in particular who are getting interested in this. And so we're suggesting that we might hold it in Cambridge.
We've already held it in Cambridge twice, you know.
The real Cambridge.
It says it's having to edit the stuff too much. As for when we hold it, one of the possibilities is to continue holding it in June or early July. Another possibility is to move it later in the year. There's an archaeologist here in Harvard, for example, who wanted to come, but he can't come in June because that's digging season. So he says, please, you know, hold it in July or August. And there's also the consideration that next year, Weiss and Soups may be in early July, and so we might want to think about whether we move this workshop to be significantly later than that rather than a bit earlier. So does anybody have any great preferences for holding it in June or for holding it in later July or August or September?
So August strikes me as a very expensive time to fly across the Atlantic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And July.
Yeah. August is security conference month.
It's true.
The later you get into the summer, I think the risk is that you run into the conferences, because we're so interdisciplinary, there are so many conferences in so many areas in July and August, that the difficulty we've got there is whichever one we choose, we're likely to be opposite a chunk of our membership. I actually like the June, late June seems to me the best time to try and get people in the lull of academic work before the major conference season kicks in.
Well, if we're going to do it in Cambridge, England, we want to do it after graduation so that we can get cheap college rooms, particularly for students. And that kind of leads us to aim towards the last week in June. The alternative, if we're doing it in Cambridge, England, I suppose, would be to aim for September, you know, when you're in the shoulder of the conference season. Room availability isn't a big deal during the vacation because conference business is off. But
the trouble is that's back into the academic year in North America.
When does America start?
September.
Variable, but we start the day after Labor Day.
Early September.
Beginning, middle September is when people start.
Okay, so the preference would be the last week in June with a possible alternative, the very beginning of September. Okay.
Well, thank you all. This was great fun. Did they do any last...
Oh, I was just
as our host, we should actually thank our host at MIT. Back for doing all the admin and logistics. And everybody for not eating in this room. You guys were great.
And Bruce and Ross for... Bruce and Ross, thank you for organizing.
We just talk more.
And finally, I suppose our commercial sponsors, Google, Microsoft, PGP,
yes, that's true.
All right.
You made it.
You did?
After a